Today on Maine Calling, we learn about turtles in Maine. You may think of turtles as odd-looking creatures known for hiding in their shells or moving slowly. But these reptiles are complex and vary quite a bit from species to species, and they are one of the most endangered vertebrate groups on Earth. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll learn all about the turtles of Maine, from the common snapping turtles with their beaked mouths that you may see in ponds, to the endangered Blanding's turtle, known for looking like they're smiling at you. We'll also find out what research is being done, especially on wood turtles, a species of special concern. What factors threaten the survival of turtles in Maine, and what can be done to help their populations from declining? Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. By Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Turtles may not be the most cuddly creatures, but they have many fascinating traits and are quite varied from species to species. Some in Maine are common, others are at risk. Today we'll learn all about these unique reptiles. This program is part of Maine Public's new outdoor series, Borealis. And if you missed yesterday's episode that included a segment about turtles, you can still catch it today at 2 and Sunday at 5. My guests are Derek Yorks, wildlife biologist specializing in reptiles with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Matthew Chatfield. He's assistant professor of evolution and eco-health at the University of Maine, and he studies reptiles and amphibians. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about turtles? What kinds have you seen in Maine? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And Derek, I'll start with you. Introduce us to what kinds of turtles we have here in Maine. I know there are several of them, so maybe you can start by telling us about some of the different turtle species and what distinguishes them.
Sure. Thanks, Cindy. Yeah, maybe I'll mention a few of the turtles that folks might be most familiar with to start with. So painted turtles are a very common species that a lot of people will see them basking, especially in the spring when the water's cool but the sun is warm. They're found in a lot of different freshwater habitats. Snapping turtles also are another one that almost everyone's familiar with. They're the largest freshwater turtle we have. They've got that attitude that no other turtle here in Maine has. And everyone has a snapping turtle story, I've found. Another one that is kind of neat is the musk turtle, and not everyone knows about them. They don't smell good if you get close enough to catch a whiff of one, but they're really cute. They're a really small turtle, too. I guess a couple others worth mentioning. The box turtle is a species that has been documented in Maine, but we've determined that we don't have any actual wild populations of them after years and years of keeping track of all the observations that have come in, even radio tracking some individuals. So they were recently delisted from our endangered species list. And one more to mention might be the red-eared slider. So it's not a native turtle species, but they do show up on occasion in Maine. They're probably the most popular pet turtle globally. And they're also on pretty much every global invasive species list. So they're kind of all over the world. They're native to the Mississippi drainage. So non-native here on the East Coast and, you know, on the West Coast of the US as well.
So if you see a red-eared slider, that's usually because it's an escaped pet or something?
Yeah, escaped, or sometimes people will release them when they no longer feel like they can care for them. It's even probably more likely.
Yeah. And some there's still more that you didn't list, so Matt, maybe you can pick up from there. There are some that are endangered or threatened as well.
Yeah, exactly. So in Maine here, we're at the northern edge of the range for the Blanding's turtle, which occurs only in sort of the southern parts of Maine, and then also the spotted turtle. So also sort of southern Maine, a little bit further north. Blanding's turtle, not likely to see them. They're endangered in Maine, but they have a bright yellow throat, sort of high domed shell, and this perpetual smile. So it always looks like they're smiling anyway because of the shape of their beak on their face.
I
And then
love
the
that.
spotted turtle. The spotted turtle is also very charismatic, again, found in sort of the southern parts of Maine. It's a smaller animal. It has sort of a dark shell and then bright yellow spots, so quite beautiful. And then another one that I'll mention that I'm especially fond of is the North American wood turtle. And the wood turtle is a sort of a northern specialist. It's found all the way up into Canada and is widespread here in Maine. And it's a little bit larger. You might see it on land, you might see it in water, and it has sort of a pumpkin orange, a very bright burnt orange color. On sort of its legs and underparts. It's quite beautiful.
And it's called a wood turtle because the shell looks like wood grain.
Yeah, it's interesting. So a lot of people think that it's called the wood turtle because it lives in the woods and why they do sometimes turn up in woods. And it certainly is part of their preferred habitat. It is because of the pattern on their shell. So each of the scutes, which are the plates on the top part of the shell and the bottom part of the shell, have rings on them. We call them annuli, and they look a lot like the annuli you'd see on a tree if you were to cut it in half.
Oh, interesting. And I know you do quite a bit of research with wood turtles, which we'll talk about soon, but I wanted to just check in with Derek about this fact that I read that turtles as a whole are among the most endangered vertebrates worldwide. And is that truly the case? And what about the ones in Maine?
Yep, it is unfortunately the case. Globally, it's often said that turtles are, as a taxa group, they're the most endangered, and I believe it's something over 50% of turtle, roughly 300 plus turtle species, are endangered on some level. Turtles have been around for a really long time, over 200 million years. They're very adaptable to many things, but they often don't adapt well to some of the things that people throw at them. So things like lots of roadways that bisect through their habitat, more development, loss of habitat, collection for food and the pet trade. Their populations are just, they don't bounce back quickly, is maybe a really brief way to say it. So anything that does harm their populations can take a while for them to recover.
So they do everything slowly, huh?
Yeah, it's true.
Well, I know the human impacts are really what's harming them, but who are the predators of turtles, Matt? Does their shell actually protect them from predators, or do they have that going for them at least?
They do. And as Derek mentioned, turtles have been around for a couple of hundred million years. So they are a very successful group. There aren't a lot of species on Earth compared to birds and mammals, but they've been around for a very, very long time. I mean, they predate the extinction of the dinosaurs. They do have a lot of predators in the wild, especially when turtles are small. So nests and hatchlings are especially prone to predation. The predators of those sort of early age classes would be skunks and foxes, coyotes. Certainly, some turtle species like snapping turtles might take one as well. A lot of the mesocarnivores or middle-sized carnivores are likely to take them. And then when they're older, there aren't too many species that can take an adult turtle, depending on what we're talking about. But certainly, like otters or some of the larger predators could take an adult turtle.
And
Mm-hmm.
Derek, you
It's a lot of
mentioned,
work. Sorry. I was going to say
yeah.
it's a lot of work for a predator to get at the turtle when it's an adult. So it's kind of a bit of a trade-off that they might not be willing to put in the work to try to extract the turtle to eat it.
So simply, if they go into their shell, there's that, that's truly a good defense.
Yeah, it often is.
Derek, I know you have tons of fun facts about turtles. I wanted to ask you about one thing I heard, whether this is true or not, that the turtles have nerve endings in their shells, so they actually feel it when you pet them.
Yeah, you know, it's something I don't know a lot about that in particular. I guess I probably can't speak to it too much. But
Matt, do
some
you
I
have
know it
a
with pet turtles, sometimes they do really enjoy being pet.
Huh. Okay. Well, I do want to shift over to talk about the research, Matt, that you're doing with wood turtles, and what you're learning about them. That's quite an extensive study that you're doing.
It is, yeah. So we have what we my sort of colleagues and I call the Maine Wood Turtle Project, which doesn't just encompass wood turtles, but most of the studies we have as part of that umbrella project do encompass wood turtles, and so we really focus our research on the ecology and conservation of the species. So we're interested in how well the populations are faring in the state. Are they sort of stable? Are they declining in numbers? Are they increasing in numbers? We're also very interested in the habitat selection, so how they're navigating these human-modified landscapes or these working landscapes, and how that's affecting their behavior and their population status. And then we have some other related studies to improve survey methodology and even the development of some conservation law enforcement tools. So
Well,
our studies really span the gamut.
and you're focusing on wood turtles because they are they're dubbed a species of special concern. What does that actually mean, and how bad is it for them, their population?
Yeah, so here in Maine, they are listed as a species of special concern, which means that they're not listed on the Endangered Species Act in the state, but biologists are keeping an eye on them because their populations are declining elsewhere. So there is some concern that they might not be faring here quite as well as they could be. They're also a priority one action species of greatest conservation need on the most recent Maine State Wildlife Action Plan. So there is quite a lot of concern in the state for wood turtles, like other species of turtles. And this is really reflective of how well the species is doing in the other US states and Canadian provinces, where they also seem to be declining in numbers there. In some places, not very quickly, but the overall population trajectories aren't looking great in a lot of places.
So you both have mentioned some of the reasons, some of the threats to turtles that are causing these declines. Derek, maybe you can elaborate on just their habitat loss. It's mostly from human impacts, right?
Right. Yeah, and the different turtle species have different habitats, and I guess one thing I'd say that say our three kind of rare turtle species in Maine, the wood turtle, Blanding's turtle, and spotted turtle, one thing they have in common is that they move over land a lot and they utilize different parts of wetlands at different times of the year. With wood turtles, it's streams. But it kind of puts those turtles at risk for being in upland areas, which are the areas where, people are doing most of their activities, including building and using roads, developing the land to various uses. So it kind of puts those turtles in the path of a lot of intensive human activities, which can lead to, them being killed directly by a car on a road, for instance, or maybe that road is just kind of fragmenting their habitat and the population is now split in two, and those turtles can't find each other as easily.
What about, we will talk more about the vehicle problems because I know people have questions about that. But Matt, we also, what about climate change and especially with reptiles, just the fact that they're cold-blooded. So are they more vulnerable to changing temperatures?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and we're as Derek had mentioned, right? Everything turtles do is kind of slow, and that includes sort of disappearing from the environment. They tend to reach sexual maturity at a late age. They tend to live a long time. So even if you don't have a lot of young entering a population, you might not see decline for a very long time, which does make it hard to study turtles in the wild and really get a good feel for their population status without a lot of long-term monitoring. Which can, of course, take a long time. Climate change is a problem for a lot of taxa, and so turtles are right there with them. With the wood turtle specifically, there was an interesting study that came out a couple of years ago that showed that some of the north states, like upstate New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, might be a climate refuge in the future, as sort of the southern populations can't inhabit those southern areas anymore, as sort of an ecosystem shift northwards. And so climate change is almost certainly going to impact turtles moving into the future, at
What
some point in the future.
What does that look like? They actually move and migrate in search of better areas to live?
It's possible that they could do that, but most turtles don't move very quickly. So it's more like northern populations might fare better and be more stable than southern populations. Although we might see some dispersal northwards, it's
Yeah,
probably
and
going to be
it
more like different survival of populations.
maybe connects in with the fact that there's so much development and fragmentation. In the past, it may have been easier for things like turtles to kind of move north or move to a different part of the landscape on a big scale, but now it's just much more challenging due to the development.
So they really live up to their stereotype of being slow in all ways.
Yeah, they
How long,
do.
you said they live really long. How long do they live?
So it varies by turtle species, of course. So some species like painted turtles, probably not more than about 10 years or so. It would be for typical in the wild. Wood turtles can live to be about 60, 70, 80 years old, it's thought. So much, much older. And then turtles in other parts of the world, like the giant island tortoises in the Galapagos and elsewhere, they've been documented in the hundreds of years. So it varies a lot, but a lot of them are very long lived.
That
Yeah,
reminds me, we didn't.
oh,
Go ahead,
sorry.
Derek.
I
Go
said
ahead.
there's a famous tortoise, Seychelles Islands tortoise, an Aldabra giant tortoise that's been on the grounds of this island, St. Helena, I think it's called. And he's 190 years old now.
Oh.
Yeah, so
Is that the
some
oldest
can really
one?
live. That's the oldest known living tortoise or turtle, as far as I've heard.
And what about sea turtles here in Maine?
Yeah, so we do have sea turtles that live at least part of the year in the Gulf of Maine, so right off the coast, but we don't actually have any sea turtles that will come ashore to nest like they do in Florida and Georgia and sort of further south. But in the Gulf of Maine, we do have a number of species that regularly do inhabit the waters and will feed up here and spend part of their life cycle up here. So the leatherback might be the most well-known because it is a more northern adapted sea turtle. But we also do have Kemp's Ridley, which is cool for lots of reasons, one of which it's the most endangered sea turtle on Earth. And it does spend at least some populations part of its life cycle in the Gulf of Maine. We also have the loggerhead sea turtle, and then possibly green sea turtles as well in the southern part, like closer to Boston, Cape Cod. They're in that part of the Gulf of Maine, but perhaps not so common up here, right off the Maine coast.
That reminds me of a very simple question. What is the distinction between turtle and tortoise?
Yeah, so I actually get that question quite a lot. Usually, sort of informally, tortoises are those turtles that have a very high domed shell and that tend to live more on land, exclusively on land or more on land. But in reality, they're all turtles. It's sort of
Oh, they
one group
are.
of turtles.
Okay, so tortoises fall under the umbrella of turtles.
Yep, as does terrapin. So there's some people that
Oh.
refer to certain species as terrapins, but terrapins are just another type of turtle as well.
Okay, good to know. Well, we're going to take a quick break right now. This is Maine Calling, and we're learning about different species of turtles and what kinds of threats they face. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Our topic today, the turtles of Maine, what kinds we have here, what distinguishes them, and what needs to be done to protect them. My guests are Matthew Chatfield with the School of Biology and Ecology at the University of Maine, and Derek Yorks, wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Share your comments and questions. Are you wondering how to help Maine's turtle populations? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call 1-800-399-3566. And calling in now is Lindsay Ware. She is founder, trainer, and handler with Science Dogs of New England. Thanks for joining us, Lindsay.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. So, what exactly is a science dog and what does it have to do with the turtles, especially the wood turtles that Matt is studying?
Well, a science dog, also called a conservation dog, is a dog that's trained in scent detection. But instead of other types of scent detection dogs that people might be familiar with, like drug detection dogs or explosive detection dogs, these dogs are trained for conservation targets. So we find whatever researchers or biologists need help finding, maybe something that's cryptic and hard to see, or a species that hides a lot, and our dogs are trained to sniff out these species for researchers.
So turtles would fall into that category of something that hides, right? They're pretty hard to find.
Absolutely.
Do you train how do you train these dogs to recognize their scent and actually find one? And what do they do when they find one? And also, how good are they at it?
Well, the training revolves around pairing the whatever the target is, so in this case, wood turtles, with the dog's favorite thing in the whole world. Before we do the training, the turtles don't mean anything to the dogs. None of the targets mean anything to the dogs. But when we teach them that when they find a turtle or they find whatever other target we're asking them to find, they also get their favorite reward. For my detection dogs, it's their ball. Then they start to understand that this target is really important to them, and they're going to seek it out. The other thing that we teach them is to do what we call an indication or an alert when they find a turtle. So for both my detection dogs, this is a lay down and kind of pointing their nose in the direction of the turtle. That way, if it's really small or if it's really dug into the vegetation, we can see exactly where this turtle was hiding. And are they good at it? They're awesome at it. These turtles are pretty easily evading us visually. So they, especially the wood turtles, when we're partnering on the main wood turtle project, they can really get in there and hide, or they can be really small and hard to see. And as mentioned, their shell patterning is very cryptic. So these dogs don't care. All they're operating on is olfaction. They're sniffing them out, and they can do it very effectively.
So how long would it take the scent dog to do that versus a human?
To find a hidden turtle?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are certain turtles that the dog might find that we might never have seen as humans. Yeah, I mean, sometimes they're just really hidden, buried in the vegetation, and that turtle and all the information that would go along with it would not have been obtained.
Yeah, so tell us then how this figures into the research and why you feel that it's important.
Well, a lot of the research focuses on getting information from the turtles, getting population estimates, and gathering biological data from the turtles. And with the assistance of dogs, we're able to find more turtles and collect more data. And not just that, but do it in a shorter amount of time. So maybe we go out and do a visual survey and find a few turtles. Well, then we add on detection dogs with that, and we might find several times as many turtles we would find just using visual surveys. So that's just going to add to the amount of data collected, which is always going to benefit the conservation of these species.
Wow, that's amazing. Dogs are just so smart. It's something else. So thank you. That was Lindsay Ware with Science Dogs of New England. And Matt, can you talk a little bit more about how that helps your research, that you're able to have these dogs doing their thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been working with Lindsay and her dog Chili for a few years now. And they sort of come as a team. So they always join us together in the field together, of course. And we've used them on a lot of different projects. All of the projects that we have that involve finding more turtles so we can mark them for a capture or recapture study, or to figure out what their habitat preferences are. They have increased our sample size dramatically. And so we're able to get more data in a shorter amount of time more efficiently for our habitat studies and our population stability studies in particular.
That's really amazing. Let's go to a question from Grace here about a turtle crossing. I often pull over to the side of the road when I see turtles crossing to assist them to the other side and prevent them from getting hit by cars. I've done this with snapping turtles too, without them biting me. Do you have any tips for helping turtles cross safely or things we should consider? And what are other ways that people can be friends and supporters of turtles when we encounter them in our day-to-day life? So, Derek, I know you have quite a few tips on vehicle, basically what to do when you see a turtle, especially on the road.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's one that I get a lot, so it's good to hear. So first and foremost, when helping a turtle on the road, you need to be extremely careful because you're stopping your vehicle, right? Or being out on the roadway, it can be really dangerous. So as long as the situation is safe, you should move the turtle out of the roadway and move the turtle in the direction that it was headed. Usually you can tell. Sometimes the turtle may be facing down the road, right, where you're coming from, or the other way, and it's hard to tell. In that case, you can move the turtle to whichever side of the road looks like a better place to be a turtle. Yeah, so that's one thing, you know, definitely can do. And with snapping turtles, I've heard a lot of different techniques for people safely moving them out of the road. I often tell people just to grab a hold of the turtle by the carapace, the top shell, above the hind feet, you know, so on either side of the tail. And you can even just kind of gently drag the turtle off the roadway that way. Or lift the turtle and hold it well away from your legs, because they really have quite a long reach with their mouth. And then just in kind of general, what was the second part of the question? Kind of general ways that people can help turtles they may encounter.
Right.
I'd say one other thing I always tell people is to leave turtles where you find them. I mean, obviously, if they're in the middle of the road, you can move them off the road safely. But some people try to relocate turtles to, say, out of a road to a pond in another town where they think it will be a better place for that turtle. And in reality, the turtles know where they're going, and they may well just turn around and try to go back where they were headed, even if you move them 10 miles away. And that may really put them in harm's way, because there'll be lots more roads to cross, lawns, etc. Leaving turtles in the wild whenever possible. If you do find a turtle that's injured, especially on a roadway, that's really common. It's great to call a wildlife rehabber, because there are a few in the state that really do a great job with turtles, and they have a good track record at actually helping those turtles heal and returning them back to nature.
So you're saying, if you are going to go ahead and pick one up, just bring it to the side of the road. Don't go further than that. Even if there's a pond really close by that it looks like it's aiming for, or do you still just not make assumptions of where it was?
If it's right there, like 50 feet off the road or something, then that's okay. But don't drive it to, you know, another neighborhood or another town.
Okay. All right. And in terms of vehicle strikes, how much of that is one of the reasons that turtle populations are declining? We've all seen them, actually, the ones that have been hit by a car. Is that a significant part of the threats that turtles are dealing with?
It is, yeah, unfortunately. And like I mentioned earlier, especially for our rarest turtle species, those are the species that are most likely to be moving frequently across roadways, because they move through the uplands a lot and between wetlands. Whereas something like a snapping turtle, mostly they stay in their wetlands, with the exception of females going out to find nesting sites. And so there may be just kind of by the way that they've evolved to not move between wetlands, as opposed to these species that bounce around across the landscape more, they're more vulnerable. I mean, the snappers are less vulnerable, probably.
What about the effort, and Matt, I don't know if you want to chime in on this, the effort to put up more turtle crossing signs that's happening around the state, can that make a difference?
Yeah, so from what I understand about turtle crossing signs, is they do come with some sort of mixed reviews. Some studies have shown that the signs, when put out at particular times of year when they're likely to cross, mostly when females are nesting in late spring, that they can be very effective to get people to slow down and pay attention to turtles that might be on the road. And in other situations, people become habituated to them and they might not be all that effective. So signs can be helpful in getting people to slow down and be mindful of turtles when they're put out at the right times of year and used well.
Yeah, I may add maybe one thing just because Inland Fisheries and Wildlife has a road crossing sign for turtles. It's mostly in the southern part of the state at locations where we've identified road mortality and turtles crossing the road frequently. But yeah, it's hard to measure how effective they are, but the signs are open seasonally, so they're hinged signs that are only open during the time of year where turtles are likely to be crossing the road. And that's really to deal with that issue of people kind of becoming like blind to seeing the same sign day in, day out. And actually, we get calls from people asking us, "I saw a turtle crossing the road. When are you going to open up the signs?" So it is encouraging, I think, on some level, because people know when they're open, they know to look for turtles. I think especially for people who have these in their neighborhood or on a regular commute.
What about the other thing I've heard is culverts, allowing them to cross through those or other wildlife as well. Are those being installed more? Are they helpful?
Yeah, we have to date, we have one purpose-built culvert for turtles in Maine. It's down in Elliott, and that was built in conjunction with Maine DOT, and it was built at a location which at the time was the worst known segment of roadway for mortality of Blanding's turtles. State endangered species, and of which road mortality is one of the primary reasons why they're endangered. And so we do hope to build more, and we have several places in mind. These are really expensive projects to make happen. So it's not like a it's not something that can be easily done in a lot of places on short order for sure. It took years to make that happen. But it is something that can be done at really high value sites where maybe you have an exceptional population of a endangered turtle species, and this has been identified as road mortality has maybe been identified as the main threat to that population. That's something you can use to justify the expense and the work to try and use that tool to fix the problem.
Okay, we've got a bunch of questions coming in. This is an email from Dale. Is there a safe way for me and the turtle to move a large and spicy snapping turtle? Matt, you're nodding.
I'm happy to take this one. Yeah, so there are a couple of ways to safely handle a snapping turtle. If you're not accustomed to it, picking them up from the back part of the shell, it's the top part of their shell, is the carapace. So picking them up with both hands from the top part of their shell and sort of gently dragging them in the direction that they were going is one way to do it. If they're small enough, you can lift them off the ground from that back part of the shell. And as Derek mentioned before, just make sure that you hold the turtle away from your body because their necks are very long and they can be very snappy. So that would be my recommendation, the back part of the shell, and gently slide them or carry them over to
That sounds easier said than done. But go ahead, Derek.
I was going to say that, especially with snapping turtles, people are often tempted to lift them up by their tail because that's the opposite of the end that's going to bite you, right? But it's actually, it's part of their vertebrae, and you could cause them a spinal injury. So you never want to pick a turtle up by its tail.
Oh, good tip. All right. We have a bunch of snapping turtle questions, so I'll try to bunch these together. One is an email from Veronica. How long does a snapping turtle egg take to hatch? I often see them laying their eggs, but I never get to see the eggs hatch.
I think 90-ish days or so, give or take. How's that sound to you, Matt? 80, 90?
So their eggs are laid, snapping turtle eggs are laid in June sometime. The first to the third week in June, give or take, depending on weather, and they'll start to hatch. Well, usually hatch in September. So,
Well, similar question here. I had over a dozen, this is from Stephen, I had over a dozen snapping turtles lay eggs at the end of my driveway over 100 days ago. Are they still going to hatch? Is that a bad sign that it's that long?
No, they could still hatch. Yeah, we're still in September, and depending on what the temperature is, where the nest was laid, it might take a little bit longer or be a little bit faster. And then certainly the weather plays into it as well.
So, yeah, and this year we had, everyone remembers June. It was rainy and cool. And with reptile eggs, there's such a long incubation period, and there's a lot. So there's a lot of kind of wiggle room, a big range in how long they can actually take to complete development. And so I'd say hold out hope. I bet they'd hatch any day.
Okay, great. And we are going to take another quick break. We are learning all about turtles in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Our experts today are teaching us about turtles, what they're like, how they're faring in Maine, what research and conservation efforts are happening to help turtles in the face of threats to their long-term survival. Joining me, Derek Yorks with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Matt Chatfield with the University of Maine. Share your comments and questions. Do you have a turtle encounter to share? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. Both of you made mention of the illegal trade of turtles as one of the threats that is also harming their populations. And is this mostly because of demand for turtles as pets? And why is that even a thing? Can you sell a turtle for that much money that there's a whole illegal trade? Derek?
Yeah. So it is, it's pets and food, though the turtles, we don't have trade in, there's no legal trade in, commercial legal trade in turtles here in Maine. But in some parts of the world, turtles are collected in large numbers for food. Though the species we have here that we're concerned about being traded illegally, it's as pets. And they do, unfortunately, sell for enough money where some folks are willing to kind of risk, you know, getting in trouble with the law to make money. So it's maybe similar to other black markets with illegal drugs and things like that, where there's, you know, obviously you get in trouble, you could face serious consequences, but there's money to be made, so people do it.
And Matt, I read something about how DNA is used to gather information to address this illegal trade of turtles. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it's used in a couple of different ways. DNA can be obtained from crime scenes, just like you might see on CSI, right, where the forensic experts sort of swab different surfaces that may have come in contact with that animal. So even in the absence of an animal, they might be able to detect the former presence of that animal and prosecute poachers that way. So so just like in a human crime scene, a poaching crime scene can be evaluated in the same way to detect the presence of illegal activity. So that would be one way that DNA can be used in that setting.
Okay, we've got an email from Herb and another snapping turtle one, but this relates to what you said about turtles as food. So he says, within the last couple of decades, there was a media story regarding the harvest of snapping turtles in Maine for food, for turtle soup, I believe, and mainly exported to the restaurant trade outside the state. The numbers were startling, many thousands per year. Is this still an issue? I spent a great deal of time on freshwater lakes in the Midcoast, and the decline in snapping turtle abundance is undeniable.
Well, in Maine, the commercial trade in snapping turtles and other species has been closed for a number of years. Prior to that, there were very few, you know, legal commercial collectors of turtles in Maine. In other states, it's still quite big. There's still a lot of snapping turtles harvested, mostly in kind of the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states.
Okay, here's an email from Joanne. We have a lake turtle that had terrorized our swim area to the point that we avoid swimming. We have 4-foot boulders on the lakeside lawn. One morning, we found that it had scaled them and dug in outside the door, digging a deep hole and continuing to stare, not smiling, and raise its huge shell, gray and beat up, vertically, delivering offspring? So any guess to what this lake turtle was trying to do?
Yeah, so it could have been a female that was nesting. So if this happened in June, there's a good chance that she was looking for a place to nest. And they do sometimes nest in gardens and in areas of the lawn. So she could have been doing that. And when they rear their shells up like that, she could have been digging or backing herself into the hole to deposit those eggs. That's a possibility. Snapping turtles can be quite aggressive. And so if this person got too close, or if they have a dog, or you know, the animal felt harassed, one of their defenses is to sort of push themselves up on all their limbs and sort of raise themselves up and make themselves look more intimidating. So that's a possibility as well.
I'd add one thing, maybe if this turtle was showing a real interest in people, like especially while it was in the water, there's a chance that someone may have been feeding the turtle. And it may have been just looking for handouts.
Oh, okay. An email from Deb. If anyone wants to see a Blandings turtle that is over 75 years old, take a trip to the Maine Wildlife Park in Gray. So they've got a Blandings turtle there. You guys had said something about how Blandings turtles look like they're smiling, which I saw pictures and they really look like that, which is really super cute. I know, Derek, you've got lots of facts that people may not know about different kinds of turtles. Do you have any favorites that you want to share?
Yeah, maybe I'll talk about Blandings turtles. They're really pretty cool. And I'm always happy to talk about them because they're like one of the turtles in Maine that I think the least number of people have heard of. And yeah, they are our rarest turtle. They live an incredibly long time. And as far as the turtles here in Maine, they're probably the longest lived species we have. We know of individuals at some of our study sites that are well into their 60s. They were marked as full grown adults in the early 1990s. But there's other studies, particularly University of Michigan study sites has documented a couple individual female Blandings turtles that were marked in the 1950s and still reproducing, still laying eggs as at like 83 and 84 years old, I believe. And this is a few years ago. So it's kind of the longevity of Blandings turtles is really impressive. And we really don't even know how long they're capable of living, but at least into their 80s.
Wow. And when they lay eggs, do most of them survive?
No. Well, the predation on eggs is really high. As Matt mentioned earlier, all these there's a lot of mostly mammals that prey on eggs, and same thing with hatchlings. And once turtles kind of become larger juveniles, subadults, and adults, the survivorship is really high. So kind of once they get past that, I often say like the bite size stage as either eggs or hatchlings, they start to they're much more likely to live year in, year out, and live for decades.
Okay, here's an email from Bill. I used to dig ponds. One day I started to dig a pond right near a customer's house, which was about 600 feet up a steep hill from a river. The customer said she was looking forward to skinny dipping in the pond. When I came back early the next morning, a snapper was laying eggs in a small thin lens of sand. I took her back to the river and never told the customer. I just turned on the radio, and perhaps you covered this, but how did she find that small lens of sand? Is this snapper behavior to do that, Matt?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure. It could be that this area that was being excavated for the pond is already in this turtle's home range, and so the turtle could be familiar with that area and patrols that area regularly. Sometimes turtles can have a pretty big home range. Snappers tend not to move very far from the water's edge, but sometimes they do make those overland movements in search of good nesting areas. So that's certainly possible. If there were some scents in the air or they were detecting some odors from excavation or other water sources, I suppose it's a possibility. I think we often underappreciate the intelligence of turtles and how well they know their environments, because they are so long-lived, and they often are very philopatric, meaning that they tend to return to the same places again and again and again, the same nesting areas, foraging areas, overwintering areas. So they really have a very good grasp by the time they're adults of what their environment, what that landscape looks like. So it's not surprising that turtles showed up very quickly, but exactly how, that is a good question.
Mm-hmm. Huh, that's interesting. Let's see, Ellen. I'm just going to see if Ellen can join us. Hi, Ellen. You're calling from Fairfield. Is that right?
I'm sorry. Let me pull over my car here.
Okay, I'll let you take a moment. We'll get back to you in just a moment.
Okay.
Go ahead. Did you have a question?
No, I have a comment. I watched a woman move a snapping turtle one day from the middle of the road, and she took a large square of cardboard. The turtle latched onto it, and she just dragged him away. It was genius.
How big was it?
It was a large guy. It was a big turtle. Yeah.
And well, thanks.
His neck did fly way out, so she would have gotten nailed by him for sure.
So, Derek, is that a technique that works that you would recommend?
I don't know that I would recommend. Clearly, it worked in this case. I don't know if I would recommend it. Because you could potentially, you know, same way you could injure a turtle by pulling on their tail, by pulling on their neck, you could also injure their spine. I have heard of people using like a snow shovel or similar thing that they just happen to have in the trunk of their car as kind of like a scoop to kind of scoop the turtle off the road. And I think that's not a bad idea.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for sharing that, Ellen. And we're getting towards the end of the show, and I just want to know, just give us some context, Matt. What happens if turtles disappear? What are the repercussions of that?
Yeah, it would really be sad if we started to lose our main species. It's just like any place, it would be sad if we started to lose turtles there. Turtles are, there's this phenomenon in ecology called called the baseline syndrome, where we our perception of the natural world is based on what we see and go out, and when we go out for hikes and explore nature. And so we're used to a certain level of turtles, but in future generations, if that number goes down slowly enough, what becomes normal might shift, right? The baseline might shift over time. And that likely has happened in a lot of areas where we have fewer turtles now and people think that's normal, whereas turtles historically used to be much more numerous. And certainly there are good examples in other parts of the world where turtles are keystone species, they're essential for proper ecosystem functioning. And that might very well be true for areas of Maine where we have lost some of those turtle densities that we used to have. Certainly, the world would be a sadder place without, you know, without all of our turtle species. And ecologically, it wouldn't be well. It wouldn't be healthy either.
Well, before I get Derek to close with some tips on other ways to help turtle populations, Patty is calling from Harpswell with a quick question. Go ahead, Patty.
Does a turtle ever lay one egg in the lawn or one egg in dirt?
Is that what you saw someplace?
Yes, it looked like the top of a fryer, like a monk's head, a bald head on the lawn. And I gently kind of dug around it, and there was one egg. So I left it there, and about 2 weeks later, it was cracked in half.
Huh.
And there was nothing there, just a cracked egg.
Okay, Derek or Matt, what do you think? Could that be a turtle egg? They look skeptical.
I don't know. their nests are often quite shallow. Like the eggs are not far beneath the surface, especially for smaller turtles. It may only be an inch or two. So if the turtle was interrupted during nesting, sometimes they'll leave the nest before they've fully covered it up. So maybe that's what was seen.
Okay, thanks so much for calling, Patty. And Derek, just a quick rundown of a couple other things maybe that people can do if they are trying to help turtle populations in Maine.
Beyond, you know, helping them on roadways, and maybe if you find an injured turtle, reaching out to your local wildlife rehabber, you can report turtle sightings. So Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, we keep track of several species of turtles: Blanding's turtles, spotted turtles, and wood turtles. So we get a lot of reports from the public. We have a data portal that is relatively new, maybe been around for about a year now, on Inland Fisheries and Wildlife's website, which allows folks to upload photos, put a point on a map, and you can report rare and common species there. And if you don't know what it is, you can also learn about what that species is by maybe using an app like iNaturalist, where people will help to identify what species you've seen.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you both for joining us today. Matt Chatfield is Assistant Professor of Evolution and Eco-Health at the University of Maine, and Derek Yorks is a wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Slade Moore took your calls, and our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.